Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, recorded on the Friday after the U.S. election, we look at how Canada needs to prepare for the next U.S. administration and Congress. Joining me is the Honorable Frank McKenna. Frank McKenna served a decade as Premier of New Brunswick and then as Canada's ambassador in Washington, where I served as a member of his team. He is currently Deputy Chair, TD Bank. Frank, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Colin. Nice to be doing something with you. We were partners for a nice period of time, and you know the respect I have for you, so this is a real pleasure for me to do this.
Well, as you know, it's entirely mutual, and I'm delighted you're joining us. For listeners, the counting is just about done. In the highest turnout, two-thirds of American voters for a presidential election since before women got the vote a century ago. We know there will be a Senate runoffs in January that will determine whether the Republicans hold onto their majority in the Senate. It is clear that the House of Representatives continue with a Democratic majority, with Nancy Pelosi the favorite to continue as Speaker. Joe Biden is likely to be inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th next year, although Mr. Trump is not going quietly into the night, and in some rambling remarks the other day, he alleged voter fraud, claimed his victory is being whittled away, and has started litigation. So we watch that space. Frank, the pollsters were right in predicting the blue wave, but I don't think anyone but Donald Trump saw the countervailing red wave. What happened?
Yeah, well, I think people will pore over the entrails for years to come to figure out what happened. But this wasn't a minor polling error. This was the battleship turning dead around in the ocean. An amazing miss, really. Now, at the end of the day, Biden is going to be the president. That's pretty well established. And he will have 3 to 4 million more votes than Donald Trump. That's established as well. But there are a lot of misses in the Senate races, state houses, governorships, in Congress. The Democrats actually lost ground. So there were some huge misses. And I think I think the Democratic Party's got a lot of soul searching to do. Clearly, people had enough of Donald Trump. When you look at the polling numbers, he's never really gotten much more than 42, 43% approval rating. He never ended up getting into the favorable territory. So people weren't enamored with Donald Trump. But I think on the other hand, the Democratic agenda scared them somewhat, and the Republicans exploited it very successfully. The left wing of the Democratic Party was very loud and very aggressive for a long period of time. Speaking of the Green Renewal Program, which they had, or defunding the police, and so on, I think was probably off balance in terms of where the American public are. And I think people felt quite threatened. I think Trump concluded a couple of things. One, that law and order was a winning issue for him, and it turned out to be the case. That the economy trumped almost everything else. It would seem almost including COVID. And that turned out to be somewhat the case. And also the fact that large physical rallies and a highly energized base could end up moving the dial. And that turned out to be the case as well. So I think if it wasn't for his character flaws, which are staggering, then he might have been reelected again. But as it was, the Republicans had a pretty good day, all things considered.
Okay, so what is it? You know, when we were down there, we dealt with sort of Tea Party, but now we've got Trumpism, which really is, again, I was astounded. The turnout, I think you point out the factors which drove people out, not necessarily supporting him, but nonetheless, they turned out in extraordinary numbers. And I think this, talking with foreign missions around the world, the Chinese embassy called me the other day to sort of say, what's this all, explain this. What's your take on Trumpism? And, you know, what does it mean for Canada, and how do we deal with it?
Well, you know, there are some practical issues, too, that Democrats will have to look at. They actually lost ground with the Latino-Cuban community. They actually lost ground compared to previous votes in the African-American community and the Muslim community. Trump did better than any Republican in the last 60 years with those communities. I think the Democrats have got some real soul searching to do there. But as for what it means for the rest of the world, I think it means that populism has not been repudiated. that there is a protectionist sentiment that can't be ignored. I think there's an anxiety that people have, Colin. I think it was part of what drove the Brexit vote and what drove the vote in the United States. And that's an anxiety about change that's inexorable and disruptive. And when I talk about change, I'm talking about technology and robotics, and talking about the fact that Uber is now the biggest auto company in the world without owning a vehicle, or that Airbnb is the biggest hotel company in the world without owning a hotel, or Amazon without owning a store. And the massive dislocation of jobs. There are still jobs, but they're different jobs. There are 5 million jobs lost on the factory floor in the United States over the last 4 or 5 years. They weren't lost to Mexicans or immigrants, they were lost to robots. And so it's hard for us as human beings to just comprehend this speed of change and not feel a large sense of anxiety. What does it mean for me and my family? And I don't think that's been addressed by leaders. And I think the natural tendency is to turtle. And in the case of the United States, the tendency that Trump introduced, contrary to all Republican orthodoxy, was to draw a curtain around the United States of America, to engage in protectionism, probably more flagrant than anything we've seen since the 1930s, and to eschew multilateral relationships, simply walk away from them. And I think it was America kind of giving a finger to the rest of the world and saying, I'm all right, Jack, and I'm going to look after me. And that's what they've done. They really drew the curtains up and decided they're going to look after America number one. And I think it's self-defeating. I think that a rising tide lifts all boats. I think America is a highly prosperous nation because of its leadership in multilateral institutions. I think the Ricardian theory of comparative economic advantage still prevails, and that the entire world is better off when emerging economies are richer and can purchase goods from developed economies. But that's not the way people in a lot of our countries are seeing the world right now. I think they're just too anxious to see that larger picture.
Do you see, is Joe Biden the kind of antidote to that? Because he is multilateralist, internationalist, someone who understands the system. You know, he's got a real challenge ahead of him. He's saying all the right things. Do you think that's the kind of person that we need to be able to deal with this series of forces, which Trump was quite successfully able to channel, and that a force that, as you've just explained, isn't going to go away?
You know, in a bizarre sort of, I don't think Joe Biden's a perfect candidate. There are probably a lot more attractive candidates around for the Democrats, but he may be the perfect counterfoil to Trumpism. Joe Biden, I think, possesses some very interesting characteristics that are the polar opposite of Trumpism. He, his very nature is a moderate. He's a pragmatist. He's a consensus builder. He comes from decades of being in the Senate and reaching across the aisle, you know, going back into those kind of glory days of the Senate when people actually work together to get things done. He's old school. He also is what he seems to be, a genuinely nice person. And I think he's got a lot of Ronald Reagan-esque type of features that may be the healing balm that America needs right now. Because God knows this election might be over, and I think it is effectively over, but all the hurt isn't going away, and all the division and the acrimony and the ugliness and the division is not going away. And I think we need somebody like a Joe Biden to just to put healing hands out there and to reach across the aisle. And that's where the rubber's going to meet the road. The left wing of the Democratic Party, which is a very energized wing, we know it well, is going to want and have already staked their claim to a large influence in a new Biden government in terms of appointments, cabinet secretaries, etc. He's going to have to deal with that. You know, if he makes a decision to double down on that left wing, I suspect that he effectively is saying, look, we're going to be the polar opposite of the Trump Republicans. We're going to retreat into our tribe and stake our claim there. I'm hoping what he does is go back to Lincoln, Band of Rivals, and something that Thomas Friedman has talked about recently, about appointing people from various political constituencies. An example, I'd love to see him reach out to Dr. Fauci to make him the Surgeon General or perhaps the Secretary of Health. I'd love to see him reach out to somebody like Kasich, Governor Kasich of Ohio, who just reeks of reasonableness, or to reach out to somebody like Michael Bloomberg of New York, Treasury Secretary, or people of that ilk, as well as obviously strong Democrats. But try to reach out and bring together a coalition that would represent more of America than just a narrow political band.
Which brings us back to your point about, in a polarized situation, bringing all the various, as you said, Lincoln did, team of rivals, is probably the best antidote to that kind of visceral distrust of the system. You know, when we were there, and I remember you were criticized, you once described the American system as dysfunctional. It soon became acceptable jargon. Now, you talk with former presidents. Is it fixable?
Well, it's interesting, Colin. I did. I really got reamed out for...
I remember.
The U.S. is somewhat dysfunctional. But I got reamed out in Canada. I didn't get reamed out in the United States. And in Canada, you know, we're always sensitive about everything and wasn't politically correct. And, you know, I was forced to grovel and so on. I remember that when I went back to the embassy the next day, I got a call from Robert Novak, who used to run Crossfire on television.
Right.
You remember that show?
I do remember.
And he called and asked if he could have breakfast with me, come in the next morning and have breakfast. He said, look, I just want to congratulate you. I heard what you had to say and you nailed it. He said, we are dysfunctional. We do have gridlock. And that's the way the system was designed. Thank you for pointing it out. We like it. And so Americans are not uncomfortable with gridlock. I think they don't like dysfunctionality. But with gridlock, generally speaking, the business community particularly thinks that it's usually the best outcome because they don't have the same faith in government that we have in Canada. They inherently distrust government and think most of what government does is inconsistent with their interests. So I do talk to a lot of former presidents and others, and they all have different takes on it. George Bush had one of the more interesting takes. He said, look, I think the root cause of this, it goes back to gerrymandering. He said, and what's happening is that a lot of the states are engaged in tailoring the electoral map so that Republicans have Republican constituencies, Democrats have Democratic constituencies. And he said what that's done is force people who want to get a nomination to go to the most activist part of the base. They can't appeal to a larger swath of the population. They have to appeal to the activist base of their party, which in the case of the Democrats is the left wing. In the case of the Republicans is the kind of Tea Party right wing. And so it's driving people to more extreme positions. Whereas if you had a statewide system like we have of reapportionment, you would probably have to appeal to moderates and people of different political faiths in order to succeed. So that I don't know that that's the entire answer, but that's one of the contributors. I think the presence of too much money, extraordinary amounts of money in U.S. politics is part of it as well. And I'm sure there are other factors, but those are a couple of the factors that drive this behavior.
No, I think that's exactly right. And to your point about the extremes, I never forget Chuck Schumer pulling out a ruler and using it to demonstrate to me, said, what we've done, particularly in primaries, is go to either extreme on both parties. And so those who get elected often come from there. They have to play to that to get elected, or they get primaried out.
Unfortunately, I don't think we fixed it with this election. This was really maybe the last best chance the Democratic Party had to put together a generational winning coalition. They didn't turn state houses. And as you know, state houses are the ones who decide on the gerrymandering. It would have been nice if they could have turned a number of them and introduced rules with integrity like we have in Canada, an independent tribunal or whatever, doing the apportionment. That would have been nice. That didn't happen. They did not end up gaining the seats to control the Senate. They're not going to be able to power their agenda. You know, they had probably the most favorable set of circumstances we'll see in some time. And now they've got a hostile court. They've got a hostile Senate. They've got a lot of state houses that are Republican. And you've often talked about this, Colin, and that's about the importance of state houses and governors. Governors represent the farm team. They eventually go on to national politics, but they also influence politics in the way in which they run their states. And missing out on that opportunity, they've really cost themselves, I think, quite dearly.
point out, it's also one of those critical zero years where they knew that this is the time when they reapportioned for the next 10 years. So that to me was one of the real disappointments from, as you say, from just wanting to see a better system, was that the Republicans held so much because they of course do not want to see change. Well, I want to turn a bit to Canada and the U.S.
because you're so smart about all of these things. One, I've been thinking about the Democratic situation on the Senate. You know, they need to win those Georgia state seats. Yeah. I never thought way they could win Maine. We know Susan Collins quite well here in New Brunswick. She's very popular. Yeah. And she's virtually an independent senator anyway, in many ways. I didn't think they could win there. I thought they had a shot at North Carolina. They should have won that. That's the one that I think they missed out on. I never thought they had a shot at Iowa or Kansas, really. Georgia will be a tough haul. But on the other hand, I didn't think Georgia was going to produce a Democratic win either. And right now, by a few thousand votes, it is in the win column. And I think it'll be a very interesting race there. The pastor is an African-American Democrat running there. He's quite popular. And if you look at the vote carefully, you'll see that African-Americans in the Atlanta area voted in overwhelming numbers. But rural parts of Georgia, the African-American vote still hasn't come out in spades. And if we could end up, Democrats could end up having Obama go in there and having other African-American icons working there and getting that vote out, he might actually have a chance of winning that seat. It would be interesting. The other thing, the reason I want to use your big brain here, the other thing is I look at creativity. Pat Toomey is a senator in Pennsylvania. Yeah. He's indicated he's not going to be reoffering in 2 years. So perhaps he's ripe for a cabinet appointment.
Yeah.
You know, what if Pat were the Minister of Transportation?
Yeah.
Pennsylvania has a Democratic governor, so he would get to appoint the replacement. So you wouldn't end up losing an opportunity by doing that. So, you know, I just think that they need to think creatively. I'd love to see them take Susan Collins and put her in cabinet. Maine politicians have always ended up in cabinets, like Bill Cohen and so on, just
right,
because they're very independent. But I think it would be hard for her, having just been elected, to accept a position. But those are the kinds of creative solutions that I think the Democrats need, because they're going to have a long 4 years if Mitch McConnell is going to be running the United States of America from the Senate.
No, that's exactly right. Well, I want to turn for a sec to Canada, U.S. And, you know, when you were our ambassador, we really did get, this was in part Paul Martin's design as well, in response to premiers who said we've got to pay more attention. So we, you know, big outreach to Congress, but also, as you pointed out, to state legislators and the think tank community. And you instituted Connect to Canada. You know, John Stackhouse has a book out now saying that we should be using the Canadian diaspora. Well, I give you full credit for giving us the capacity to be able to do that, to reach out to those Canadians studying, working, living in the U.S. Your assessment now, sort of 10 years on, of that initiative, what more could and should we be doing when we've got use of technology and things? I know you think about this stuff, and it's all about the Canadian messaging in the United States. Any suggestions?
Well, I think to start with, we're pretty good at this. My reading is that Donald Trump would have preferred to tear up NAFTA than he would have been to replace it.
Yeah.
And I think it was only at the last minute, when he went up to the Hill and discovered that Canada had more friends there than he thought. He was basically told, look, you're going to have to get a deal because we're not prepared to support you in tearing up this treaty. And that's as a result of the work that you and others have done over a long period of time in creating relationships between senators and cabinet secretaries and governors and premiers and so on. And I think that we have to double down on that kind of diplomacy. You know, the tone at the top is important. We, God knows, especially when you have such a 4 years as we've had, to have a civil tone at the top will be good. But a lot of the real work gets done down below. It's Chamber of Commerce to Chamber of Commerce. All the members of civil society with their counterparts, neighbors, friends, relatives, all of the above. And so we need, I think we need to make this effort much, much bigger. Connect to Canada on a big scale. We have a million snowbirds probably or more going into Arizona and Florida and so on, mixing with their American neighbors every day. Right now, I can tell you in the last couple of months, the ones that I talked to are appalled. they just feel uncomfortable with the conversations that are being held. But we need to get all of them electronically connected and armed with information and made allies. And I think we need to reach deeper into American society and connect it to Canadian values. We need to do more what we used to call familiarization tours, inviting governors up to spend 2 or 3 days in Canada, inviting senators to come here. What always shocked me was the degree of ignorance there was about Canada and the United States. They instinctively liked us, but it's the same way you'd like a nice polar bear. They're cute and cuddly, but they didn't really know us well enough. And now we need to dig deep so that they know us better and understand that not only do we share a piece of earth, but we also share a lot of cultural values and that we've got a lot of history together. We've shed a lot of blood together and that we need to be connected even more closely together. So I think we've got a lot of work to do, and creative minds, especially in this age of social media, I think could have a lot of fun in trying to connect some of these dots.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I remember one of the better programs that you gave us the go ahead for was to bring sort of fledgling state legislators, because as you point out, there is a continuum that we don't see in Canada, where you go from city council to state legislature to Congress to the Senate to governorship and back, and then succeed. And I thought that was, again, that outreach was exactly what we should be doing. I pay tribute to you because you were the catalyst that allowed us to do things that we were thinking about, but you gave us the permissions and the support to move forward. And I do think the last couple of years, this is what the Canadian government and that Team Canada Inc. did around the renegotiation of the NAFTA. It wasn't just the Prime Minister and Chrystia Freeland. It was also premiers, provincial legislators, business like yourself, labor going down. And in order for us to be able to, as you pointed out, convince Americans that this deal was also in their favor.
Yeah, and Canada, to its credit, it was Canada Inc. There was really separation in all the political leadership across all the political constituencies. I go back, to the old days when we fought the original Canada Free Trade Deal. That was taking place during my first mandate. And our country was really torn in two, as you are almost literally in two over that deal. Well, you know what I found really interesting was that in this last go-round with USMCA, virtually all political constituencies were aligned. There really was no major domestic fight in Canada about the importance of this trade deal. So we've come a long way on that. Now we just have to extend our diplomacy, as you would say. We need to go right down to the farm team, to AAA baseball, and work our way through and twin with mayors and twin with state senators and twin with legislatures and provinces and so on. And everybody likes a good trip, and bring people up. Let them see our energy sector. Let them see our hydro sector. Let them see our technology sectors. Let them know Canada the way we know Canada. And I think all of that's just like money in the bank for a time when we might really need it.
No, and I think that, as you, one of your great phrases was, we need 1,000 points of contact at every level. And that still holds true. And so I guess as you look back and think your various experiences, both as premier, as ambassador, and in the private sector now, managing states, Congress, administration, any other sort of insights? I certainly take on the importance of relationships, which I think a lot of this comes down to. But are there any other sort of ideas that you might have that for dealing with the, this massive cacophonous circus that is the United States?
Yeah, I think to start with, we have to respect their democracy. It's a raucous, brawling democracy, but it is a democracy. And our role is to respect the choices that they make. And I'm really pleasantly surprised, Colin. It must have been so tempting for political leadership in Canada to use Trump and the U.S. as a foil. Because God knows in Canada, it wouldn't be more than 15 or 20% of people who would have any respect for Trump. And if you were to run against Trump here, you'd be quite successful. But the Prime Minister and others have resisted that temptation to their credit. I even when I was there, we had a few grenades lobbed in from Canada created some awkward visits to the White House for me. Now that's not the case. Canada's showing extraordinary discipline, and I think we need to keep doing that. We also need to avoid being sanctimonious, and God knows sanctimony comes quite easy to me and to others in Canada. We don't have a perfect country. We have challenges of our own, and we need to fix those. So, Colin, I'm beating a dead horse here, but I think that we need to, when we have all our eggs in one basket, we need to watch that basket, but we also need to perfect ourselves as a country in other ways. We need to get rid of our interprovincial trade barriers once and for all. We need to have a more efficient economy. We need to deal with regulatory excess. We need to take advantage of the trade agreements we negotiate. We keep talking about how we're the Phoenicians of the world and trade with everybody. Well, they trade with us. We don't necessarily trade with them. We've got a terrific deal with Europe, CETA, but they trade more with us than we do with them. We're not taking advantage of it very well. And the same with Asia. We've got to understand that we can't just talk about diversifying our trade. We have to actually do something about it. When Trudeau Lepere was prime minister, he got into a fight on tariffs with the United States 50 years ago, and he said we have to diversify our economy. I think it was 71 or 2% of our exports went to the U.S. Today it's about 75%. So 50 years of trying, that's all we've done.
But that's exactly. And I just want to, on the reach out to the rest of the world, because as you point out, you know, we've got these, and we do proclaim ourselves be the Phoenicians, but what is it that makes it difficult? I know governments try all levels, and I think the provincial governments are often best at this because they know who really is ready. Federal government sets the framework, and I think that's their role, but we aren't succeeding. Again, you point out with Europe how they've increased their trade, and we've now got opportunities in Japan, but still Canadians, their preference, and again, the polling tells us this, is to trade with the United States. So programs we have for new exporters, particularly minorities and women, again, they tell us they want to trade with the U.S., which underlines, again, why that market is so important and why we got to deal with it. But the diversification one is a real conundrum. And I know you've thought about this and you described it. How would you deal with that? I mean, this is one that really is a conundrum, because certainly governments put a lot of emphasis on trying to do trade diversification. But as you know, it's business ultimately to business that makes it happen.
Well, to start with, we just have to face facts. We trade with the U.S. because it's so darn easy.
Yeah.
It's just a gravitational pull. You know, water runs downhill and we're up there, up here, and they're down there. And it just seems like our water runs there. As you know, our family, we have a kitchen cabinet company here that my son owns and operates, one of the biggest ones on the East Coast. A good percent of our production, 40% maybe or more, goes right down into the United States, right down I-95. Easy as can be. We don't sell in the West because essentially we're blocked at the Quebec border. That's the nature of Canada. There are tariff barriers and there are other obstacles, but for Atlantic Canada, we see Quebec as almost forbidden territory. It's very hard for us to do business there. Easy for us to do business in Maine and New England. So that's a problem we have within Canada that we need to get a little better at. I think we also need to do a better job with the rest of the world in not being so sanctimonious. Look, I know we're in trouble over the Meng Wanzhou situation with China, but we were in trouble before that when we sent a trade delegation over there headed by the prime minister and basically decided to instruct China on their values. And they basically handed us, you know, our suitcases and told us to go home. That's fact.
Yes.
We've lost our relationship with Saudi Arabia. You know, you could argue we might be on the right side of it, but at the end of the day, the relationship is gone because we decided we were going to lecture them a bit on human rights. In the case of India, we had trade missions to India that turned out to be a total disaster for us. That's a massive economy. We've got a huge diaspora in Canada of people from India who are highly successful and could be very influential. We need to take advantage of that. Colin, I don't know if you remember, but I was part of the Team Canada approach, and we missions all over the world, and we didn't go in and instruct people on their values. We went in and talked about trade. We would acknowledge values issues, but we didn't spend our time being sanctimonious about it and moralistic about it. We have to recognize that every country has its own particular set of challenges and they're dealing with them in their own different ways. We don't like people telling us what our values should be. So we have to be careful about doing that with others. And so So I think that's something that we have to dispense. We have to become more, I don't know how you would put it, just perhaps more pragmatic in the relationships and stop going to places and telling them about gender equality and sexual equality and diversity and human rights and everything else. We can't ignore those issues, but we shouldn't be leading with those issues. I'll just tell you about our trip to China with Prime Minister Chrétien. The press were all over him, as they always are in Canada. You know, what are you going to do about human rights? What are you going to do about human rights? You got to fix human rights in China. Yeah, fairly big job, you know, but we got to fix that. So we go in and we met with the president of China and Prime Minister Chrétien, the ultimate pragmatist. He said, look, first on my list are human rights. He said, so check that off. Now let's talk about the economic issues. and then went out and told the press, yeah, the first thing I talked about were human rights. But in fairness, President of China said, look, I appreciate you raising human rights. You got to understand, we take it quite seriously here, but we've got 1.2 billion people. And we are trying to modernize in a way that will not blow the country up and create the world's biggest problems. So I hope you respect the challenge that we have. Now, I don't want to relitigate all of these issues, but simply to say that I think that we do have to be a little bit pragmatic on some of these trading relationships and hope that we can influence countries and in different ways through our own behavior.
No, I think that's exactly right. And very good advice. I want to turn now to just Canada-US, almost put back on your old ambassador's hat. We've got a whole lot of issues. There's the COVID recovery, reopening the border for tourism and sort of business travel. We're still implementing a new trade agreement, and there's challenges there around the new rules of origin. And I was just reminded today when I did an interview with CBC that in Quebec, they're unhappy about U.S. access for dairy. Which will come back at us. There's, of course, the climate and the environment, which the Prime Minister puts big value on. There's energy. Premier Kenney's, you know, concerned that Keystone may not proceed because Mr. Biden has suggested otherwise. You've got Build Back Better, which is potentially a $2 trillion infrastructure program, which certainly offers opportunities, I think. You've got the Huawei and the 5G issue with the Americans having a view there. And then they put pressure on us as continuing, not just with the Trump administration, but Obama on defense spending. And we've got the new North warning system. And then, as you pointed out, we've got China and our desire to get the Michaels back. If you were giving advice, well, I ask you, well, how would you prioritize? Because as the other thing, you know, is you can't go in with everything at once. You have to figure out what's gonna work. What advice would you have for that sort of first call and the follow-up call between the Prime Minister and likely President-elect Biden?
Yeah, so you know, there's no doubt we can't boil the ocean, but I think that this is a chance for muscular diplomacy on a number of fronts. I think the first thing that I would do is invite President-elect Biden to visit Canada. That was historically the first visit that a U.S. president made. Trump did not come to Canada for 4 years, except to do a little fly past at Charlevoix, where he kind of swooped in, crapped all over us, and flew out again. But in terms of a real visit to Canada, there have been none. And I can't think of a better way of starting the new relationship off than doing that. That's easy. We don't need the Senate to approve that in the United States. So it'll be up to Biden to do that. And then there's some areas. I think Keystone XL will be a difficult challenge. I do. I think we need to pursue it, but it's not quite as urgent today. We do have Enbridge number 3. We do have Trans Mountain. We do have a lot of debottlenecking taking place that's getting our energy into the United States. But on climate change, our energy sector is exposed to a very vigorous set of rules around methane emission, carbon reduction, et cetera, that the United States is not under the Trump administration. If Biden levels the playing field, that would be good for them, good for us, and good for the planet. Yes. So I think we can be very supportive of the environmental safeguards that were part of his agenda to the extent that he can implement it. I think we're simpatico on that. I think Biden and Trudeau will be totally simpatico on environmental issues. And then we get to the USMCA. In actual fact, this week, we had a huge announcement in Oshawa, 2,500 new jobs as a result of an investment there. And the participants in that announcement, rightly or wrongly, I think rightly, are saying this has come about as a result of the new NAFTA, the USMCA and the rules of origin and the North American content. So that's a win, let's say, and let's celebrate it as such. USMCA, I think, is working. I don't think that in itself is going to be a major irritant, by the way, because the Democrats were part of the negotiation of that, added some things that made it more acceptable, and largely voted for it. So I don't think that we have a hostile Democratic Party, as sometimes was the usual case, on this trade file. Then we get into some specifics. I don't think we can solve softwood lumber. With the Biden administration, we couldn't with the Trump administration, we couldn't with Obama administration. But if we simply support the United States in appointing appellate judges to the WTO, we have a process to get to a solution. So instead of trying to, again, do something that's impossible, which is forcing the Biden administration to spend a lot of political capital on that issue, if we can simply reinforce what I think their instincts are, and that is to be part of the WTO and participate by appointing the appellate judges, we will get to a decision that I think will be in our favor. Now, similarly, this is tenuous, but it at least gives us a shot at a win. Another one, and I think I'm perhaps being a little overly creative here, but I hope not too. In the case of China, we should be making out like a bandit with China while they're fighting with the United States, but it's all hung up on this Huawei Mengwangzhou situation. That's a very big irritant. But all of that arises from the decision of the United States unilaterally to pull out of the Iranian Comprehensive Treaty and to reintroduce sanctions. And Huawei's accused of violating those sanctions in Mengwangzhou, et cetera. But if the Biden people go back to the original Iranian Comprehensive Treaty and gradually withdraw the sanctions, it may be that the Huawei and Mengwangzhou are no longer offside. In other words, it may be that the raison d'etre for our apprehension of Mengwangzhou may end up going away, or the United States may say, well, look, that was all about Iran, and now we've got a different view on Iran, so let's grant some relief there. It wouldn't be a big ask for our prime minister to say, can you help us on this single file? Because we've got two ex-diplomats, really, who are suffering in Chinese jails as a result. We need some help with you on that. If they would help us on that, I think that we could restore our China relationship fairly quickly. There'll be some lingering bad feelings, but that I think is the causa bella of that relationship problem. So, you know, I hope I'm making sense to you, but I'm just offering a few pragmatic examples of where, without burning up a lot of political capital, we may be able to get the United States to come to a good place that would be good for us and good for them.
Oh, these are all exactly the kind of ideas that what this podcast is about, is to put this stuff up. And how do we do this? You've been spent much of the, since you left Washington, private sector, working with the bank. Debt and deficits are going to be a big challenge and continue to challenge governments going forward. What advice have you got? You've managed a province. You know, you've now been dealing with not just the TD Bank, but your other corporate responsibilities. What advice are you giving to federal, provincial, and local governments as we want to do things, but our fiscal capacity is going to be somewhat constrained simply because of debt and deficits?
You know, Colin, I think a large part of sovereignty is not only having your borders secure, but also your financial situation secure. And you look at Europe after the financial crisis, those countries that were overextended became in a lot of trouble. And they lost a lot of forward momentum. And they had to basically kneel at the altar of Germany and other countries in order to try to curry favor and find financing. Canada, I like the way that our finance minister is talking. She's saying that we have a well-deserved reputation for fiscal probity and we're not going to blow it. And that we enjoyed the best financial ratio, GDP, debt to GDP ratios, et cetera, the G7, and we're not going to walk away from that. I hope that's the case, because that gives us huge leverage if we can do that. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, in my view, that we have to spend on the pandemic. That's just the right thing to do. Yeah. Our citizens need that security and we need to do it. But we can make those one of rather than structural if we're smart. If we make those structural, then we're going to be in big trouble for a long time to come. So we've got to figure out how we can make these one of expenditures not structural. We can also concentrate on the things that will allow us to recover with flair. And I'll give you two or three examples. One, I think that we shouldn't go through an acute program of austerity. There's a time and a place for that. We went through that when Prime Minister Chrétien was in and Paul Martin was finance minister, and we hit a wall. And as a provincial premier, I paid a price for it. We all did. We did the right thing. We made the country stronger as a result of it. But we did it in a world that had lots of economic firepower, and we could withdraw some of the stimulus from our own domestic resources. So now I don't think you can do that. On the other hand, you should do a constant pruning. That is like a continuous rolling project management, continuous look at the expenditures of government, expenditure review on a constant basis, just constantly paring, pruning. So you're doing austerity in a different way. It may be that we need to reduce the manpower in government, the number of public servants, maybe by 30 or 40,000. Well, why don't we do that over 2, 3, 4 years through natural attrition? Just pruning. That's on the one side. On the other side, I think government would make a mistake if they were to dump a big tax burden on individuals or businesses. There's nothing that's more discouraging to investment than to be spending your time with tax lawyers and accountants trying to figure out how you can avoid some tax. And it's not what you need. It's not consistent with a growth agenda. So I think we need to hold the line on that. So where does the money come from then? It can only come from one place, and that's growth. You know, we do have to reinforce the idea that we have interest rates that are at historical lows and look like they'll be lower for longer, for a lot longer. And so borrowing costs are low. So we need to grow faster than the rate of interest that we're paying on the debt. And that informs me that what we need is a growth agenda. And I've talked to some cabinet ministers who I respect a lot, who are saying that from their perspective, every decision is going to be made through that prism of growth. Is this consistent with growth? And using that prism, you could say daycare is a legitimate expenditure because of the growth that will come from that. You can say that we have to spend on long-term care facilities through regulation and actual money, because if we don't have security for our most vulnerable citizens, then we're going to continue in lockdowns. We have to do that. But I think there are other things that we have to do that are consistent with growth. And that would, in my view, means breaking down interprovincial trade barriers, yeah, doing deregulation where you can, lubricating the wheels of industry so they can make decisions better. Immigration. I can't think of a better way to stimulate growth than increasing our immigration targets, which we're doing, by the way. I think it's smart. And making sure they're distributed across the country, and making sure we take advantage of the dislocation in the world to get the most skilled students and the most skilled workers that the planet has on offer. That will fuel our economy as well. So I think if we pick smart things off the menu, making sure we've got a really robust rural internet everywhere in the country, that we're a digital economy, that we're an innovative economy, highly productive economy, all of those things will allow us to keep a step ahead of the cost of servicing the debt.
Frank, your optimism is always inspirational. Thank you. I think that's a terrific set of recipe that indeed should be followed. I have one last question for you, and it's some popular with our listeners. What are you reading these days when you get a chance to read?
Well, I tell you, I've been reading two books, and one of them, for reasons that'll be obvious to you, I've kind of put away. And that was Jeffrey Toobin's book. and so I've kind of set that aside for a moment, but I've just finished up John Meacham's book on Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And right. I found that pretty inspirational, considering, you know, what you'd have to say is the tediousness of the current economic debates. When you go back through some of the great leaders, you realize, you know, the difference that leadership makes. You and I both know this, but yeah, when you look through the great leaders that brought America to where it is today, when you look at the old G7s that you and I would have recognized, the Margaret Thatchers of the world or the Ronald Reagans at the time, the Helmut Schmidts and others. And I think losing Merkel is one of the great losses on the planet. She's pretty lonely as a world-class leader right now. So it'll be nice if we can recreate that leadership cadre. But I like reading books about truly great leaders and just how much they've moved the dial through their leadership.
You're absolutely right. And you, I can say, are an inspirational leader. And I think that's how we're going to deal, to take us back where we begin, as you described, the populism. That's how we'll beat Trumpism. It'd be inspirational leadership on the other side, and it can come from the right and the left, but that's what we need.
Well, Colin, look, I know you have to go, but I just want to say this. Who have you heard standing up and speaking for globalization or for rising tide lifting all boats, for how helping the developing world can help the developed world? Who has been talking about immigration, what a richness it is to society? I don't hear much on the other side of this debate. So it's no wonder that people are prey to the allure of populist messages.
No, and as you've said before, you don't give up the field. You stay out there and make your case using the facts. Well, thank you. Thanks for listeners for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by the Honorable Frank McKenna. You can find the CGI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Charlotte Duval-Lantoine and to Drew Phillips for the music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.